Pranam to the lotus feet. Sai Ram, their devotees. The bhajans were very, very nice. I thoroughly enjoyed them. And I'm sure the Swami also enjoyed them. Since he is here just even more real than me and more real than you. When I think of bhajans, I very often think of a lady whose name was Lalita Bose. Did any of you know Lalita? Any of you going back far enough to know Lalita? Yes. She belonged to the Bose family of Bengal, who played a very prominent part in the struggle against England for independence. And she always carried with her a big Krishna doll. And she was such a bhajan singer that Swami, whenever she started to sing, Swami would start to dance. He couldn't help it. Wow. She had such a wonderful lilt to her bhajans. But otherwise, she didn't amount to much. A sign of a famous family. But to carry a Krishna doll and sing bhajans, that was really all she could do. So Swami thought to make her independent. So he arranged for her in Bangalore a small business whereby she could take homeless ladies and teach them how to hand-paint saris, because there's always a market for hand-painted saris. But since Lalita wasn't much good for anything else except what she was doing, as I said, at the end of the month, every month, there was just total confusion, because none of the bills had been paid. Nothing had been paid, yet the money had disappeared. She didn't know where it went to. Nobody else knew where it went to. So Swami would come there once a month, the end of the month, and ask her, well, now Lalita, what? Well, Swami, there are these bills, and, well, where's the money? Well, Swami, I don't know. There's no money. So Swami would simply, in exasperation, move his hand like that, and the whole table would be covered with money. And the bills would be paid out of that. But that didn't last for too long, maybe less than a year. And then Lalita, I don't know where she went to. I haven't heard of Lalita since that time. But speaking of money, too, there are two money stories about Swami which I participate in, and which are always the source of amusement to me. I really relish those two incidents, and perhaps I should tell you about them. One time, it was like in the early days, Swami used to take me with him wherever he went. And wherever Swami went in the car, I would go with him. And one time we came from Bangalore up to Kudapati, and we stopped at the state of the division district chief of police. A friend of Swami's and a good devotee, and Swami often stopped off there for lunch on the way to Puttaparthi. And then we went on to Puttaparthi. Then after two or three weeks, we went back to Bangalore and again stopped at the house of the chief of police. Well, as you probably know, many of you do at least, you followed Swami in your cars and you've seen what happens. When Swami leaves Puttaparthi and starts for Bangalore, there are people lined up on the road, you know, quite a long ways ahead. And Swami stops and gives them money. They're waiting for Swami to ask Swami for money. Well, Swami knows that, and he gives them money. Then he comes to a Mohammedan village, and when he enters that village, the children all rush for the car and follow the car and pound on the doors of the car. And usually Swami will stop and call one of the mature men and give him some money to buy sweets for the kids. Well, on this occasion, Swami gave away all the money he had, and there was still some distance to go. So I had a roll of rupees in my pocket, you know, small stuff, like we have twos, fives, and tens. And so I reached in and said, Swami, please accept. This is a gift from me. Please accept this, Swami. So he said, all right. So he took my money, which was now his, mind you, not mine, and gave it out until we passed, finally passed all the people who were waiting for money. Then we got to the, then he gave it back to me. After he finished giving out the money, he said, well, put it in your pocket. Mind you, it was still his money. It wasn't my money. Put it in my pocket. So I did. So we then came to the chief of police house again, and we stopped. Now, perhaps you noticed the protocol with Swami in the car is that you get, that is, when the car stops, or when, let's say, when the car starts, you're starting someplace. Now, protocol is that you get in first, the guest gets in first, passengers get in first, Swami gets in last. But when we come to the destination, it just reverses. Swami gets out first, because the people want to see Swami, not the passenger. And then, after Swami is well clear of the car, the passenger gets out. So Swami got out of the car, he was in the back seat, as he always was, and I was always in the front seat with the driver, where I always was. So he gets out of the back seat and walks, and there's a whole bunch of people lined up in front of the house of the policeman. And Swami walks up to them, then I see him giving these people, the policeman's money, the servant's money, Because apparently when we come up before, he usually tips them, and he had to miss tipping them when we went from Bangalore to Puttaparthi. So now he wanted to tip them. And so he started to give them money. So I said, money? He's giving the money? Boy, you get money. He hasn't got any money. He's got a pocket. No money. Mind you, he didn't come within 10 feet of me. He got out of the car, never came near me, yet the money came out of my pocket. It was his money. And he had it there to give to the servant. That, every time I think of it, it amuses me. Another one about money, too, is that in the early days when the hippies were there, they were really totally useless. Swami would give so much attention to them, talk to them most lovingly, take their hands, and then he would try to get them to do something. Maybe there's some work to be done in the print shop, so we'd try to get them to do some work in the print shop. They would refuse. All they would do is sit in the veranda and smoke marijuana, and so on. And so, in those days, often parents wanted to get hold of these hippie children of theirs and bring them back home. And so sometimes they would contact Swami and ask Swami's help. So Swami would find the children sometimes and send them home, but they had no money. How could they pay their passage? So what Swami would do then would be to go up to one of the American devotees and say, now, I will give you rupees, and you give me American money in exchange for the rupees. And that way, he would get the American money for the tickets. Well, I watched that going on, and I thought, gee, that's sort of silly. You know, here's the Lord himself has to go up to people and say, give, let's trade pesos for dollars. This didn't seem right. So I thought, well, the next time I came back, I got a couple thousand dollars in small bills, $10, $20 bills. And so when I got there, Swami at that time had a Jeep. And whenever I would arrive, he would put me in the Jeep and we'd go for a drive. So with Swami, you don't hand him something, you know. You hold it. And then if he pleases him, he'll say, what have you got there? And give it to me. So I was holding this bill, a big bundle of bills, in a paper package, and on the drive, and finally Swami said, what have you got there, Islam? So I said, well, Swami, I have a couple thousand dollars in these $20 bills, so that when you have to get money to send some of these foreigners home, it will be easily available. He said, oh, all right. So that was all he said. Well, then, Prasanthinilayam, there are a group of older men, old-time devotees, Indians all, who have the privilege of going into Swami's room and upstairs to his room upstairs. And there they sit and chat with him before he retires at night, and or for his siesta in the afternoon, and so on. So Jogarao, anybody know Jogarao? You know Jogarao. Quite a few people know Jogarao. He's an army man, and he is Swami's constant companion now. Wherever Swami goes, he is in the car with Swami. And the last time I was there, I heard that there was going to be a 50-foot-high, what's the monkey's name? A statue on top of one of the hills. And so when I'm there, I always wait. I don't go away with it like other people do. I wait because I know Swami will come out and maybe he'll then invite me to go in the car. So this was Sunday, and he passed right by me and didn't invite me. And they went on a tour. Then the next day, Jogarao called me over to his room and said, on Sunday, we went up to where the statue was going to be of Hanuman. And he said, Swami wasn't pleased with the design they had. So he simply moved his hand like this and created a statue of Hanuman as he wanted it. And then Jogarao said, here's the statue. It was heavy. It must have weighed 10 pounds at least. Quite large. Beautiful statue of Hanuman. And so that is what they're going to create. So Jogarao is one of those chaps who had the privilege of going up to Swami's room. And so that day, then they were out, and then Jogarao came down, and he passed me, and he said, you know, he showed me some money to trade our bills. He said, Dawg, he said, you know, we had so much fun. He said, Swami said, here, Hisla brought this money. Who wants some? Who wants some? And he handed that entire $2,000 out to those people sitting in front of him. So that puzzled me for quite a while. And Swami did that. Then I finally figured out what the problem was. You remember with Shirdisai, how he would always test people with money? You've read the life of Shirdisai, I'm sure practically everybody here. And when people would come up to Shirdisai, and he would say, give me 100 rupees, give me 50 rupees. He would demand money of the people, his devotees. By nighttime, it was all gone again. He'd given it out to people that needed it. But nevertheless, he tested the people, you see, by demanding money. So here was Shirdisai in the body of Swami. And here I, the fool that I was stepping between him and his devotees. Here he was dealing with his devotees with in terms of money as he had his Shirdisai, and I stepped in between with my $2,000 and stopped him from contacting his devotees. So I consider myself lucky that I didn't get the punishment much worse than that. But now, this is Ganesha's birthday. So what is Ganesha? And Connie thought it was Krishna's birthday. And what is Krishna? Do these people really exist? Did they ever exist? Or do they exist now? According to Swami, first of all, according to Swami, there's life every place. Every level of existence is just chock-a-block with life. Every level of subtlety, the entire cosmos is filled with life, filled with beings. And one time, a theosophist asked Swami, you know the theosophists, they have these masters, the theosophical masters of the Himalayas and the letters, Mahatma letters and so forth and so on. And so he asked Swami if these Mahatmas, these masters were real. And Swami said, yes, they are just as real as you are, but no more real. Now, what did he mean by that? They're real as you are. That is, they actually exist, the same as this body exists here. Now, I wonder how many of you know Mr. Nakul Sen, or Mrs. Nakul Sen, the ex-governor of Goa. It was at the Nakul Sen's palace in Goa. The Swami had that horrible appendicitis business where all the doctors came from all over India. I told Swami said, I'm going to go down and talk in a couple hours. And Swami, he's a doctor, said, Swami, we are the best doctors in all of India. And we tell you, we're sorry to tell you, Swami, in half an hour you're going to be dead. And of course, Swami, exactly what he said, got up from his bed, walked downstairs, and gave a talk. Well, Nakul Sen was telling me one time that he had there in Goa somebody that he always invited to come to the palace when there were visitors. And this chap could stand in a circle of 25 people. And he could move his hand like that and create 25 different options. That is, whatever was in the mind of the person in the circle, this man could create something for them, just exactly like Swami does. But Nakul Sen told me that he could do that only after praying to Durga, you know, the goddess Durga. Mm-hmm. Only after praying to Durga. So Swami has said that just like the executive of a great corporation, the chief executive officer, CEO, he doesn't deal with every sub-manager or every customer or every prospective customer. He has heads of departments who take care of production, distribution, advertising, and so on. So in the same way, Swami said, he, the Lord, has great executive staff. And these divinities, then, they exist, like Durga. They exist, and Ganesha and so on, and they have a function, that is, they play a part in this, what? In this real world? No, in this world of Maya. This world of make-believe, which doesn't really exist at all, except in our imaginations, created by Maya. But whether Ganesha or Krishna or Hanuman or whoever exists, for us, that shouldn't be a consideration. What we should do is not worry about the small towns and the chieftains and the kings between us and the road to the capital where we want to strike. We're striking for the heart of the situation, for the capital. So we should strike for the capital. We conquer the capital, then automatically we're the master of all the other towns and cities in the kingdom. So what is that capital for us? What is that which we are striking for? You see, maybe there's somebody here who can say the same thing that Swami does. Swami says, I am always in bliss. I never worry about anything. Nothing ever bothers me. I am always in bliss, ecstasy. Now, who here can say that? I don't see a lot of hands. So, then why are we here? Why do we come to meetings? Because if we had that fountain of bliss, that fountain of beauty, of love, of bliss, of ecstasy, rising up, and always new, ever fresh, as Swami says, then we would be happy not looking for this or looking for that. So, at the basis, that is the basis of our worldly existence. We're always looking for something. We want to enjoy, we want to be prosperous, we want to be happy, we want family, we want importance. All these things we want because of the vast emptiness that is in us. We want to fill that emptiness with all these things having to do with the physical world, with the satisfaction of desires, and so on. And all the while behind that, what we are really striving for, longing for, is that fountain of ecstasy, that fountain of bliss coming up from within. There's a fellow called Swami Rama. Maybe you have seen one of his books. He wrote about his life in the Himalayas. He has some big organization in the Midwest. Very nice chap. And he grew up as a boy in the Himalayas mountains and living with the yogis and the people there as a boy wandering around. He wrote a book about it, a very, very interesting book about his experiences as a young man doing that. And in one instance, I remember, he came to a yogi, well-known yogi, and he had with him somebody that he wanted to talk to this yogi. And they waited, and I think they made some little noise, and finally the yogi came out of where he was and said, "What do you want?" And this chap, Swami Rama, said, "Well, here's so-and-so wants to talk to you." So the yogi said, "All right, but why did you do it?" He said, "I was in such bliss with my guru, with my God, and now you call me out of that to talk in this physical world." So in him, he found that source of bliss, even though he had to be in deep meditation, samadhi, in order to experience it. But with Swami, there's no samadhi necessary. He has that fountain of bliss coming up within his heart every moment of the day and night. The same with Ramana Maharshi. He had that fountain of bliss all the time. You remember Ramana Maharshi had the cancer coming out of his arm. This great sage, Ramana Maharshi. And the devotees wanted to operate. He didn't want them to operate, but they wanted to sit for it. So the operations were all unsuccessful, and the tumor kept coming out again. And someone said to him, "Swami, there must be terrible pain with that tumor pushing through your arm." And he stopped for a moment and sort of thought. And then he said, "Yes, there is pain, but I am not in pain." He made a clear distinction between the body and himself. He knew from his early experience as a young child, young boy, where suddenly he had felt he was going to die. And he lay down on the floor and fixed his body as though he were dead. And then he realized that body is dead, I am lifeless, and yet I am still there. So, he became conscious of this I, this self. And he said, never for one moment for the rest of his life did he let loose of that consciousness, that I. And Swami says the same thing, that once we realize and feel that depth, that reality, grasp it, never, never let it go. He said, even if you feel some temporary happiness, some temporary bliss, grasp it. Don't let it go. Hold on to that bliss. That's the only real thing. The rest is all just imagination. So that is what is what really we are striving for. And we would like everybody else to have it, of course. So then how are we going to reach that culmination, the satisfaction of that fundamental desire? We do it according to Swami's instructions. Now just, you know it already, but we should always, every time we talk, before we get to other topics, we should recapitulate or go over again the basic fundamental things. So then, what are the steps? How do we go about finding ourselves, that which we really are? How do we contact and be that source from which everything comes and flowers and arises? Swami tells us that it can be done by purifying the mind and purifying the heart. The only reason now that we are subject to this Maya is because our heart is not pure and our mind is not pure. It's filled with desires and disappointments and angers and hatreds. But if we can purify the mind and the heart,
by seva, by prayer to God, by meditation, by watching ourselves and seeing what we're doing. Because if we see ourselves doing an ugly act, that's all that's necessary. It will fade away and disappear. And we can also purify the mind and the heart by reciting God's name, whichever name of God appeals to us. Sai Ram Om, Sai Ram Om, Sai Ram Om, Sai Ram. Because Swami has told us that there is no separation between the name and the form. You say God's name, God's form is there. Om Sai Ram. Swami is here, his form is here, beside me, every moment. And likewise with yourselves, if you repeat the name of God, Swami is with you. You can take his hand and walk through the day with him, holding his hand. Now, if you're walking down the street, holding Swami's hand, how are you going to let feelings of hatred and anger and cruelty arise? It's impossible. Likewise, sitting at home. Maybe Swami is sitting on the chair, arm of your chair. Or Swami says, when you're at home, you should imagine Mother Sai. Be seated at her feet. And treat her more lovingly, more gently, with more open affection than you would even with your own mother. Now, there was a lady. She came there one time. Was in the same interview as was I. And Swami said to her, don't hug me quite so tightly, you're hurting my knees. So then we asked her later on, what does Swami mean? Well, it turns out that at her home, she would be there and imagine Swami. She was sitting at Swami's feet. And she would hug him. In her home, so far away in India. And Swami said, you're holding me too tight. You're holding me quite so tight. So, if we can conceive or imagine that Swami is with us every moment of the day, then the task is done. Mind and heart will automatically be purified. Hatred, anger, all these cruelties that go on through the world are flowers of the dark, flowers of the night. They can't survive in the light of the sun. And Swami is that light of the sun. You have him with you, and they can't survive. They wither away by themselves without any effort on your part. No effort is needed. Just they disappear, and you never feel them again in Swami's light. Now, in this task we set for ourselves, people around us haven't set that task. They're quite satisfied with the world as it is. But we Sai devotees set ourselves a task of finding out the secret of bliss, the secret of ecstasy, the secret of freedom. And for that, Swami says, and so do all the scriptures I've read right through Ashtaraka and the other great sages, that it's extremely important to take the form of God that you have chosen, personal God, and keep it in your mind all the time. You remember the story of the two guardians of heaven, and they committed some sin and were to be expelled from heaven, and God gave them a choice. He said that you can incarnate as my devotees and have 15 or 20 rebirths, and then you can come back. Or, you can incarnate as my enemies, and you only have to take two births. Why was that? Because, how much throughout the day, those of us who love Swami, how often do our minds wander off to this and that, and memories and friends and anticipations, and then suddenly we remember Swami. Then the mind goes away again. So the mind is not on the Lord all the time. But how about at your enemy? You're thinking about how will I get even with that guy? Oh, how I hate him. What he did to me. I'll get even. See, The enemy is thinking all the time. So these two fellows then, enemies of God, were thinking of God all the time. And that was enough to dispel all ignorance and bring them back. So, that is the heart of our task, is to remember Swami all the time. Dedicate every action to Him. When you come here, instead of getting in the car, you say, Swami, I dedicate this action to you, Swami. I am not the doer, Swami. You are the doer. I am just the witness. All my life, Swami, goes by like a picture, like a moving picture in front of me. All caused by karma. That which has been fought or felt or done. It has its effect. And here's this show going ahead in front of me, Lord. But I have nothing to do with that. I am separate from that. I am I, and I am thyself, and therefore I dedicate everything that I do to thee, O Lord. Swami has said that again and again. Krishna, in his instructions to Arjuna, as to how to reach liberation, and of course, due to the English language, we can't say it correctly. We say how to reach liberation. That is quite wrong. We are already liberated. We have the feeling, because of language, that we are human beings striving to mount up and up to God, to freedom, to liberation. Quite untrue, according to Swami and according to the sages of ancient India, too. God has come down and taken human form. It's not that we have to ascend to God. We are God. Swami said in so many words that when somebody asks you who you are, instead of saying, oh, I'm Hyslop, you should say, oh, I'm God playing the role of Hyslop. You are God playing the role of all these people. And so he says that you should think always as though you were an actor in a play, playing your part, even thinking your part and feeling your part with all your might. But you never forget who you really are. That when the play is finished, you'll go home. We said, always think of yourself as just a player in this drama of life that goes through every day in front of us. We are just playing that part. We're on our way home to God. And he said that if this drama ever seems to be and becomes real to you, then deny it. Deny its reality. You are not this body, or this mind, or this personality. That is just a part that we are playing in the divine drama of the Lord. That part we are playing, we must play it to the best of our ability, but never forget who we really are. The lady, millionaires, with a large, great home, lovely family. In the play, she plays the part of a street lady. Full of sorrow and anguish, and the crowd weeps, the audience weeps with her. Even though she's playing her part so dramatically and so realistically, do you think she ever forgets who she really is? That when the play is over, she'll take off the paint and the wig and get in her Rolls Royce and go home. She never forgets that. Likewise, it should be with us. No matter how much we get involved in this Maya of the world, we should never allow ourselves to believe that is really we who are involved. We are God. We are the witness of all this. We are God playing a particular part on the way back to Him. So if we wish to find this fountain of bliss, this ecstasy ever fresh, then we must think these things through and reach the firm conclusion that we are divine.
This I, God's, Swami says, that I, without anything added to it, I am a man, I am a woman, I am big, I am small, I am young, I am old, just I, without anything added to it, that I is God. That is God. So, we should watch our own life. We can see that as we go through life, no matter what happens to us, I remains the same. Day in, day out, you go back into yourself, sink back into yourself as all of you can, and you will see that this I has never changed one iota since your earliest memory as a small child. It's the same I precisely. Hasn't learned a thing, hasn't forgot a thing, hasn't changed. Exactly that I. That's God. So we should see that, feel that, and not let ourselves be caught up and carried away by the rush of events in our daily life and get lost. That's for us as side devotees. The people of the world don't care. They're not interested. Not interested. They love these great dramas like taking place in Saudi Arabia now, and the movie queen and the entertainer and all that business. Their time will come. Our time has come. Our time has come. How lucky we are to be born at this time and know of the Lord, know of Swami, hear this wonderful teachings of Swami, and be in a position to put it into practice.
Anybody have some questions?
In the light of what you've said, what is the point of all the knowledge that we all accumulate in the lifetime? And then we die and all this knowledge, whatever, I don't know what happens.
Yes. You see, I said to Swami one time, Swami, I want to understand this. Something I want to understand. Swami said, yes, look, you will find that as you get along, you will be less and less interested in understanding. Because, you see, in understanding there is he who understands and that which is understood. Duality. Therefore, false, unreal. The only reality is God. Everything is God. Nothing else is God. So all this understanding, all this learning has to do with duality. When we merge in God, we lose this imaginary individuality we have and become God. Now, to understand God, you have to be God. Because the mind with which we are thinking came after. Not before it. Therefore, the mind can't go, language can't go beyond the mind. And God is before the mind. So therefore, Swami says, we shouldn't worry too much about that, but we should practice and practice and practice being detached. It's impossible to get free, impossible to realize the divine without detachment. And detachment comes about through thinking these things through. See, Swami says about human beings that human beings have special powers given by God. One of those special powers given to the human person by God is the ability to think things through, reason things through. That's a God-given trait to the human person. We have the ability, every person here, to sit down quietly and think these problems through and see the truth. Now, if we see the truth, Swami says, none of this sadhana is necessary. You can forget the whole thing. Forget bhajans, forget seva, forget prayers, forget meditation, forget the whole business. Because all that is simply aimed at gaining the truth, seeing the truth. So we can think things through and penetrate them and see to the heart of them. And then we have the strength of will, the willpower, to put them into practice in daily life. That willpower is divine willpower. We all have it. We call upon the willpower of the divine to change our life and according to our deep understanding of the situation as it is. We stop allowing our life to be managed by our senses or even by the wanderings of the mind. But the intelligence is in charge of the mind, in charge of the senses, and that can and will operate if you call on your own willpower, call on God. And as far as events in the daily world are concerned, our actions in the daily world, what should we do, what shouldn't we do, we can always get the answer by asking conscience. Swami tells us again and again that God resides in me. He's the only real thing there is. Everything else about me is imagination. But he resides in me as conscience. And therefore, by asking our conscience, we can ask God directly, and our conscience will give us the correct answer. No, I think my hour is up. Thank you for listening to me.